Persons listening to this show should experience...
Well, I'm Dr. Scheidbach. Excuse me for interrupting one of your favorite parts of the brain massage, but I'm in Colorado, about to begin the two and a half hour drive to Denver, where I'll catch my ride home. And the more I look at my schedule, the more convinced I'm becoming. I'm not going to be able to do justice to a brain massage show with the time that I have. So, in honor of Veterans Day, I thought it would be good to think about what our soldiers are fighting for, ultimately. So I'm going to present an encore of One Nation Under God. God bless you. God bless and heal our land. God bless our vets. And God bless you. And I'll see you in church.
Traditional God-fearing patriotism is being assaulted on every side. Hundreds of examples could be cited, but there is one that is developing right now in our courts, and I think it perfectly reflects what is happening in our country generally. The Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco ruled the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional. Why? Because it includes the expression, under God. Is the court simply being consistent with the notion of separation of church and state? Or is this another step out from under the protection of divine providence our forefathers depended upon when founding this nation? The court's ruling has brought out into the open the most important question facing Americans today. Is America one nation under God? Is America one nation under God? In the Bible, God says, "Come now, let us reason together, saith the Lord." Can we be reasonable about this? Our court used to think differently than it does today. In 1892, Supreme Court Justice Josiah Brewer wrote the unanimous opinion in a case called Holy Trinity, in which he said that in, quote, American life, as expressed by its laws, its business, its customs, and its society, we find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth, that this is a Christian nation. And friend, this goes to the heart of our discussion. You see, the secularists want to remove all expressions of Christian influence from our laws, our business, our customs, and our society. But what did our founding fathers have to say? Recently, the University of Houston concluded a 10-year study in which 15,000 documents of our American heritage were compiled and compared, and it was shown they quoted the Bible more than any other source. George Washington said it was impossible to govern without God and the Bible, and that every patriot should be a Christian. At the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin said, "I have lived a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men." And Patrick Henry reminded all the delegates that America was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ. And yet, godless secularists display a shocking arrogance when they accuse our founders of using God talk merely to manipulate the people to support their effort to create a secular government. Those who make this charge are guilty of reproaching the memory of the dead who are conveniently no longer here to defend themselves. They cast an evil slur upon the character of good men for their own gain. They are guilty of slander against the heroes of freedom, liberty, justice, who paid the price for our liberty. Nonetheless, even the most skeptical secularists will have to admit this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. You see, their scandalous lie about the framers rests upon an admission regarding the people. We, the people of early America, were overwhelmingly Christian, any way you look at it. America was founded by Christians on the gospel of Jesus Christ, just like Patrick Henry said. This does not mean every American was a Christian. Nonetheless, it cannot be denied that Christian beliefs and values served as the foundation on which our founders constructed this government. Every honest student of history must see that our nation was started by people who identified themselves with the Christian faith, and that our laws are built upon the Bible. And so our coins say, "In God we trust." And so our pledge declares, "We are one nation under God." Our history declares it to be so. To what conclusion does an honest regard for history compel us? We are one nation under God. And while I am sensible of the many blessings this has afforded us, I am also sensible of the great danger we face in forsaking the God of our fathers. We cannot destroy the foundation upon which our liberties rest without toppling the liberties that rest upon it. Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble when I reflect that God is just." Well, I also tremble when I consider that as a nation, we are scorning what the founders feared to be without, the protection of divine providence. Dial 911 to your memories operator. Perhaps you're thinking, doesn't our Constitution require the separation of church and state? Come now, let us reason together. The First Amendment provides for 6 laws that protect our most cherished rights. The prohibition against the establishment of religion, which is called the Establishment Clause, together with a provision guaranteeing the equal entitlement of the free exercise of religion, which is called the Free Exercise Clause. A provision guaranteeing free speech, together with a provision guaranteeing a free press, and a provision guaranteeing the right to peaceable assembly and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Did you ever notice that all of these are grouped together in one amendment? It is one sentence and it addresses one subject, and that subject is liberty. It was through great travail for religious liberty that the First Amendment was given birth and amended to our Constitution. Consider the birth of the First Amendment. In May of 1776, a convention met in Virginia in which the grandfather of our Bill of Rights was drafted. It was called the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Some objections were raised against the use of the word tolerance in the Religious Liberty Clause. You see, the Baptists, represented in that meeting by their friend James Madison, believed their right to free exercise did not come from an edict of toleration. They wanted it clearly understood that their religious liberty came from God, and on that ground was unalienable. After much debate, James Madison won the following language, which satisfied all in the assembly. Quote, "All men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion." The public debate that gave birth to the First Amendment was not over freedom from religion, but freedom of religion. So where did this idea of separation of church and state come from? Perhaps you have heard about Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, where he used the expression wall of separation between church and state. But have you had the opportunity to read that letter for yourself? Jefferson was not talking about restricting the influences of religion in our government. He was assuring those concerned Baptists that the Constitution prohibited any church from using the powers of government to restrict the free exercise of others. For over 150 years, every case in our courts was ruled on the basis that the First Amendment protected the freedom of religion. Nevertheless, in 1948, the court started interpreting the Establishment Clause as though it was meant to prohibit the government from endorsing or encouraging the Christian religion. The result has been that the Establishment Clause is today interpreted in such a manner that it contradicts the Free Exercise Clause. But this contradicts the Founders' purpose. It contradicts 156 years of case law, and it is contrary to the simple wording of the amendment. The language of the First Amendment says, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." The word "or" shows us that both these clauses were to work together to achieve the same end, religious liberty. To lift the Establishment Clause out of its context and use it to violate the Free Exercise Clause is outrageous. These lawyers and judges attempt to use the language of the Constitution to defeat the very liberties it was written to protect. So, what is the Establishment Clause all about? Remember that the Constitution and Bill of Rights were birthed in an historical context of a culture that was essentially Christian in its beliefs and values. The Establishment Clause was intended to prohibit any particular Christian sect from using the power of government to interfere with the religious liberty of others. But this will only work for a society which is essentially Christian in its morals and values. All laws are the extension of the collective values and beliefs of a community, which is why lawmaking in America is assigned to our representatives in Congress, and it's not supposed to be done in the courtrooms. Let me illustrate for you why our founders so often said that our Constitution is inadequate to govern irreligious people, and why they believed Christianity was the only religion that would support the liberties we cherish. I'm sure we all can agree, murder is immoral, and so we have laws against murder. Suppose we continue down the road to paganizing our society to the point that some nut argues her religious beliefs are violated by our laws against murder. How? Well, human sacrifice is part of her religious beliefs, let's say. She wants to be sacrificed to her pagan god without exposing the officiating priest to a charge of murder. Of course, now, we would consider such a group to be a dangerous cult. You see, our laws against murder are understood within the context of our culture. Obviously, the framers constructed our government within the context of a Christian culture, and our Constitution will not survive in the hands of a people who are not essentially Christian in their values and beliefs. Christianity has traditionally been encouraged in America for the simple reason that it was the cultural force that created the government in the first place. So when George Washington encouraged every patriot to aspire to be a good Christian, he was not establishing religion. He was encouraging Christian morality with the full understanding that without it, our system of government could not long endure. This court's recent ruling is contrary to our history. It is contrary to early case law. It is contrary to the Bill of Rights. It doesn't even make legal sense. One principle of legal interpretation is that if the consistent application of a law leads to absurd results, it's bad law. Well, consider, of our nation's founding documents, none is more precious to us than the Declaration of Independence. However, application of this law would require us to ban the Declaration of Independence from our public schools. Why? Well, consider all this unconstitutional religious terminology. Like, quote, the laws of nature and of nature's God, end quote. And these that warm every American heart, quote, all men are created equal, end quote. And, quote, all men are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, end quote. And in this official document of state, you have the entire legislative body of the Continental Congress declaring they are, quote, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world, end quote. And by the way, they were not talking about the Supreme Court justices. And then, Thomas Jefferson, who was charged with the responsibility to phrase the collective sentiments of the Congress, concluded this document saying they proceeded, quote, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, end quote. A protection, mind you, we have scorned and spurned and have lately begun to lose. Dial 911 to your memory's operator. See those towers crushing down upon Manhattan. If the pledge is unconstitutional, we must conclude the Declaration of Independence is unconstitutional. And I certainly hope that's absurd to you. Jessica Reeves writes for Time magazine, and she would have us know that some lawyers agree with the notion that, quote, in the strictest reading of the Constitution, there is no room for religious terminology in what should be a secular space, end quote. Did you know there was a space in America where your religious liberties have no constitutional protection? It doesn't make you a bit edgy to think our courts can arbitrarily create a space where they can suspend constitutionally protected rights? Come now, let us reason together. Does it not follow? If our courts can suspend one of our unalienable rights, it can also suspend others? Are any of our rights safe in the hands of this court? Why do some want to destroy the only foundation our forefathers believed would support our liberty? Different people and groups have different reasons. Some have been offended by individual Christians, perhaps with good reason. Not all Christians honor the name. Some are offended at the intolerance and bigotry that has been exhibited at certain times in history by so-called Christian institutions. May I emphasize the expression so-called? Some are offended by what the Bible says on the subject of hellfire, or sin nature, or abortion, or sodomy. But generally, folks are not aggressively campaigning to push religion out of public life only because they disagree with it. To understand the aggressive, even the fanatical opponents of God-fearing patriotism, it's helpful to distinguish ideological opponents and sociological opponents. Ideological opponents are those whose beliefs and values are contrary to traditional American ideals and beliefs. These despise our form of government, and I think rightly understand that Christianity is their primary obstacle to their effort to convert America into a godless socialist state. Incoming, blinding missile of insight right at your head. But don't duck, listen up. That's what the communists in Russia thought. That's what the communists in China think today. Secular nations have never been friendly to freedom. Sociological opponents of conservative Christianity come from among those whose lifestyle is condemned by the morals and values of our Christian culture. There are many examples of this, but let's take only two. Atheists are of the ideological sort. An atheist family sues the Boy Scouts, for example, because the Boy Scouts have a policy of admitting only God-fearing patriots. That's because the Boy Scouts want to promote God-fearing patriotism, you know, the kind George Washington encouraged. Come now, let us reason together. Is it reasonable that everyone who does believe in God and wants to have a boys' club made up of children who want to pledge their faith in God, that they should all be deprived of their privilege to do so? No, their rights and their religious liberty and freedom of speech. What right is the atheist being deprived of? The right to be a Boy Scout? Where is that in the Constitution? Let them start their own scout program. Let the atheist humanists start their own red shirt brigade for all I care. That's their right. These evangelical atheists, as I heard one atheist call them, show their true colors when they work to infringe upon the religious liberty of their neighbors. My friend, the antagonism against Christians in this country is irrational, and by the way, it is un-American. The homosexual is an example of the sociological opponents of conservative Christianity. Their lifestyle is clearly condemned in a culture that's dominated by Christian values and beliefs. And America is behaving so irrationally in this manner, it's frightening. In Africa, where the culture is not Christian, homosexuality is openly accepted. Many think that's how America ought to be. But these countries are being devastated by AIDS. 20 million already have died of the disease, and multiple millions are expected to die of AIDS in the next few years, leaving hundreds of thousands, even millions of children orphaned. Did you know the only African country where remarkable progress has been made to curb the spread of AIDS is Uganda? So what is their secret? Uganda launched an aggressive campaign to reduce promiscuity by encouraging moral standards and purity. They worked to make chastity popular. You see, morality matters. It saves lives. More than 1 million teenagers in our society will contract a sexually transmitted disease this year. Morality matters, my friend, and character does count. Pornographers, pushers, pimps, and pedophiles traditionally have been considered deviants in our culture, and this is because of early Christian influence on our social values and morality. Well, these people don't like being thought of as deviant, so they work to change the norms of American moral standards. And as those standards get lower and lower, have you noticed the deviants are becoming bolder? Stealing our children from our bedrooms and from our front yards to rape them and kill them and throw them aside like trash. And yet the media elite and entertainment industry in this country generally do everything they can to advance the agenda of the deviants in our society. We are engaged in a new civil war, and the battle is for the hearts and minds of our children, and it's not fought with bullets and cannon, but with words and laws. And my friend, you'd better get enlisted. Your liberty is at risk. Godless regimes have never been a friend to civil liberty. To engage in this civil war, you're going to have to understand their strategy. Those who would destroy our foundation of Christian values and beliefs know that in order to succeed, they must control the education of our children. Benjamin Rush of the early 1800s, signer of the Declaration of Independence and founding father, whose importance rivaled that of George Washington, was one of the early champions of public-supported education for all Americans. Mr. Rush understood the importance of providing Christian training in the schools. He warned that, quote, "The great enemy of the salvation of man, in my opinion, never invented a more effectual means of extirpating, which is to say, removing Christianity from the world than by persuading mankind that it was improper to read the Bible at schools." End quote. Did you know Abraham Lincoln said, "The philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation becomes the philosophy of the government in the next." Secularists understand this. They knew from very early on they would have to get the Bible and Christianity out of the public schools if they hoped ever to destroy the Christian foundations of America. For about 100 years in this country, a significant number of public schools continued to provide Christian religious instruction for students as part of the regular school program. The humanists rightly perceived that Christian influence interfered with their agenda, that they could not compete with its influence, and they quickly realized they would not be able to remove this obstacle through the legislature. So they took their cause into the courtrooms of America, where clever lawyers and judges began twisting the words of the Constitution, interpreting the First Amendment in a fashion that virtually contradicts its original purpose. Some evangelical atheists claim that when other children exercise their freedom of religion in public, it somehow infringed upon their First Amendment rights. Do you not see the absurdity? Did you know the old Soviet Union constitution provided for the freedom of religion? A former KGB officer was asked, why then did the Soviet Union not allow Bibles to be sold in bookstores? His answer reminds me of how our courts reason today. He explained that it was because this would violate the right of non-believers not to read the Bible. The public schools have become secular space where constitutional rights of Christians are routinely violated. But just how secular is this space really? You know, other religions are okay. You can read Harry Potter to our children in the public school where they are exposed to witchcraft and pagan values and morals, but you cannot read Paradise Lost and Regained or Pilgrim's Progress or the contemporary bestseller Left Behind series. New Age religious beliefs can be discussed and even promoted by teachers. Even the Islam faith can be explained and the Quran can be read in our schools. Anything that will further the agenda to weaken the Christian foundations of America. But you can't tell them the truth about our Christian heritage. You better not read from the Bible. Here is an overview of how the court succeeded at pushing God out of the classrooms of America. In 1948, the court outlawed teaching religious education in the public schools during the school day. It took about one generation to prepare America for the next step. In 1962, the court ruled that prayer in the public school was unconstitutional. In 1963, the court decided Bible reading and recitation of what is commonly called the Lord's Prayer was forbidden. In 1968, the courts decided evolution could be taught in the public schools. And by the way, with this case, they established the legal basis that has been used to remove any mention of God or creation from the public schools. It is no surprise that in 1980, the courts removed the Ten Commandments from the walls of our public schools. And then, June 27, 2002, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the Pledge of Allegiance unconstitutional because it includes the expression under God. If that decision stands, the next step will have to be to rule the Declaration of Independence unconstitutional, as we've mentioned. And if we don't wake up, the courts are going to destroy the Bill of Rights. And mark my words, America, you will no longer enjoy liberty and justice for all. Because when religious freedom goes, all other rights and freedoms become fair game. And our Statue of Liberty must cast down her eyes in embarrassment, and our founders must be ashamed of us. And how can God be otherwise than insulted? They will continue pulling us out from under the protection of divine providence, and unless God-fearing patriots wake up and start pulling back, and I mean hard, we are going to lose more than our national security. We're going to lose our liberty. What has movement out from under God accomplished for our nation anyway? You heard the 60s called the decade that changed America? Well, no kidding. The 60s began with the courts kicking God and the Bible and prayer out of the public schools. The secularists will be pleased to know that in 1963, at least 65% of all Americans believed the Bible is the actual words of God. However, by 1981, this had declined to 37%, and by 2001, it was down to 27%. In 1963, the number of Americans who viewed the Bible as a book of fables and legends was only 11%. In 2001, it was 20%. Oh, but what have we done to our children? From 1957 to 1963, the percentage of 18-year-olds who had premarital intercourse was steady. But from 1963 to 1981, it went up more than 100%. And today, most girls in the public school claim to have had sex before they are 16 years of age, and that age keeps getting younger. At least 1 million teenagers will contract a sexually transmitted disease this year. Pregnancies to unwed women 15 to 19 years old tracked right along with population growth from 1955 to 1963. In 1963, it broke away and shot up from about 100,000 to over 500,000 in 1980. I appeal to your reason, man. Think about this. And you know the chances of these children becoming criminals is like 300% greater. The chances of these children repeating the pattern of unwed pregnancy is something like 500% greater. Contemplate the impact on our society. The suicide rate moved down from 1947 to 1955. That's when the sexual revolution began to get rolling, and the suicide rate began climbing at that time, but it really broke away in 1963. It shot up like a Titan rocket out of Vandenberg, increasing around 500% among young people ages 15 to 24. And you know, the trend today is not only are more and more of our kids killing themselves, but more and more of our children are killing each other. violent crime tracked with population growth from 1951 all the way to 1962, but in 1963 it broke away and climbed from 255,000 to 1,277,000 violent crimes in 1980. A 500% increase. The divorce rate in America declined pretty steadily from 1948 through 1962. However, in 1963, it begins to creep, but only slightly up. Then it rises more than 100% from 1963 to 1980. A child's sense of belonging, his sense of identity or sense of stability, all of these stand upon the family. Divorce is an earthquake that shatters a child's world. And it's almost always related to petty selfishness and covetousness and immaturity, infidelity. And who pays? The children pay. Multiply this agony by more than 1 million divorces every year. And our young people are not learning how to establish and maintain families. America's lost her moral compass, and she's killing the conscience of her children. Our children are dancing to the Pied Pipers of immorality. They're being used in humanist social experiments like lab rats. They're being seduced away to Pinocchio's Pleasure Island, where they're going to be turned into the donkeys that will be forced to carry the burdens of a collapsed culture. Oh, friend, they take our children from us, degrading their human dignity, soiling their innocence, and destroying their future. In New York Harbor, there stands a lady holding high the torch of liberty. Will she continue to hold forth that torch as a beacon of hope to the world, or will she cover her eyes in shame while the godless and the deviants in this culture wrest the torch of liberty from her hand and use the flame of precious liberty to set our children ablaze in sensuality and violence? God has something to say to you, America. In Jeremiah 2:19, the Bible says, "Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, and thy backslidings shall reprove thee." Hello, I'm Jerry Scheidbach. Thank you so much for listening. If you would like to have the complete message, One Nation Under God, on CD, sent to you free of charge, please call 888-770-8000. Your next brain massage is scheduled for this time next week. God bless you. God bless America. See you in church.
The science of a brain massage. The brain masseur uses words like fingers to massage your gray matter, forming insights in the mind that stimulate the pituitary to signal the adrenal to release noneparephrine neurotransmitters and to fire these neurons through the sympathetic nervous system affecting the heart. The skilled brain masseur uses incisive logic to arrest our attention and nuanced razor-sharp rhetoric to cut away the tangled knots in our brains. When these knots are removed, the electrical impulse of stimulating insights fire the neurotransmitters so they can leap the synapse gaps. This generates a sparkling effect in the brain that can cause the countenance of a brain massage listener to glow. Additionally, sudden outbursts of energy caused by the release of glucose throughout the body increases the heart rate, while the pituitary gland in the brain releases all five types of dopamine at once. And this creates that sense of euphoria experienced by many brain massage listeners. And that's the science of a brain massage. The battle for America is on. Jesus sent his Spirit into the world, and the Bible says, "Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty." Satan is the spirit of Antichrist. America is divided between those who follow the spirit of liberty and those who follow the spirit of tyranny. The spirit of Jesus Christ or the spirit of Antichrist? Election 2020 will decide whether America continues as one nation under God or falls fully into the power of the spirit of tyranny. Go to GodsWar2020.com.